I encourage you this morning to join me in the Word of God in the third chapter of the book of Ecclesiastes as we speak on the subject, Joy in the Seasons of Life. And I want to begin by reading in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, beginning in the first verse. To everything there is a season and a time, to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy good in all his labor, it is the gift of God. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it, that men should fear before him, that which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. May God bless to our edification his own holy word today. I wonder if you've ever known anyone that you would characterize as a real-life, homespun, common-sense philosopher. I'm not talking about somebody who was necessarily schooled in philosophy, or someone who has studied the philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre or John Locke or Soren Kierkegaard. I'm talking about an old-fashioned front porch wise man or wise woman, as the case may be. Someone who had spent time thinking seriously about life and the world and had developed his or her own unique insights and understanding on how the world works and why things are as they are in life. I suppose that in my life, I have encountered probably half a dozen or so of these kinds of people, people that I would put into the category of being a common sense, down-to-earth, front porch philosopher. In fact, as a young person, I believe that my life was positively impacted by sitting around listening to them talk, asking them questions. Each of these people that I've known had certain traits in common. Each of them was in touch with nature. At least four of them were farmers or ranchers. One was a fisherman. One of these people was a woodworker who spent a lot of time whittling, carving, shaping small objects made of wood. These were interesting folks that I had encountered during my tenure as a young man. Not only was each in touch with nature, each was hardworking. Yet they made time each day to sit on the porch, sometimes at the close of the day, as they quietly observed, and maybe sometimes with a knife and a stick again, sometimes with a cup of coffee, sometimes with a good book. But as they mused upon life, these homespun philosophers made time to sit still. That's something a lot of people don't do anymore, to sit and think. The Bible says that the heart of the wise studieth to answer. You know, there aren't many folks anymore who just sit around and just study on things. Somebody says, "What are you doing?" "I'm studying." And you say, "Well, what do you mean studying? I don't see any books." "No, I'm thinking. I'm thinking about life." You know, a lot of old timers used to sit on the porch. They might smoke a corncob pipe. They might spit a little tobacco juice. They might chew a wheat stalk. They might whittle a little bit. But I'll tell you, some of those folks had wisdom that the Ivy League professors, the eggheads and intellectuals in this world will never have. Have you ever known anyone that you would categorize as a homespun, front porch, common sense philosopher? Each of these that I've known have been people who had a certain quietness and contentment about them. They were slow to speak and swift to hear. In fact, if you wanted to know their wisdom, most of the time you had to ask leading questions. You know, it's like that proverb that says, "Counsel in the heart of man is like deep waters, but a man of understanding will draw it out." They weren't quick and free to just say, "Let me tell you what I think about this." They were very quiet, content, self-controlled individuals. But as you talked to them a little while, you'd find that they had unique insights into how nature moved, how birds migrated, how coveys of quail would find cover. They knew where to find things in nature that a lot of people today just don't know those sorts of things anymore. Now, there aren't many of these folks around anymore. There are too many distractions in our world. Life is too fast-paced for folks to sit on their porch. Have you noticed they don't build front porches on houses anymore, as a rule? Why is that? I suspect it's because folks don't sit and rock. They don't look at the bluebirds. They don't look at the hummingbirds. They don't observe nature. We've got the television to keep us busy, right? We fill our lives with 24/7 talking heads, noise. Something has to be playing at all times. Have you ever noticed how many modern people live? They get up in the morning and the first thing they do is turn on the TV or the radio, some kind of noise so that we don't have to actually stop and think seriously about life. There's a verse in the 5th chapter of Isaiah that says, "Woe unto them that lay house to house until there's no place for man to be alone." He's talking about filling our lives with so much busyness that we don't take time to sit and think, to be quiet. Silence and solitude is considered to be a negative instead of a positive by many people today. So there aren't many of these folks around because most of the world is just too busy. And I wonder if this may be one reason that so many of our young people go off to college and have their faith shaken by a professor, because they find these eccentric people in positions of leadership, these educators in the post-secondary educational levels, and sometimes they're strange and unique, and they start listening to these folks, and it's the first time that some of our young people have ever actually listened to somebody because their face has been buried in the iPhone for all these years, you know, or in the television or in the video games. To actually sit and think and to listen to somebody's perspective, that's why it's so dangerous for some of these people to be in positions of leadership, because especially if they don't have a biblical life and worldview, they can influence our young people. Isn't it a sad thing to pay tens of thousands of dollars to send a child away to school only to have them begin to question the integrity of the Word of God, the Genesis account of creation, everything that you've believed? Say, and we've paid for it. That's the sad thing about it in modern society today. I suggest not only are there not many philosophers left today, but many modern people really aren't interested in philosophy. I've actually had people tell me that. "I'm not interested in philosophy." James Montgomery Boyce said, "We live in mindless times, days in which millions of people are drifting along through life, manipulated by the mass media, particularly television, and they hardly even know it. Few give thought to their eternal souls. And most, even Christians, are unaware of any way of thinking or living other than that of the secular culture that surrounds them. You say, I'm not interested in philosophy, Brother Michael. I have news for you. Philosophy is interested in you. Everywhere you and I turn, we encounter philosophy. Did you know in every ad campaign, there is some kind of life and worldview being promoted? How about, you deserve a break today? Is there philosophy in that? Somebody says, well, that's right. I do deserve a break today. I'm important. Or somebody says, have it your way. And you say, that's all I've been waiting for, somebody to tell me that I can have it my way, because I very seldom get my way. Oh, there is philosophy in the popular media culture. Every media form, whether it's print media, broadcast media, movies, television, music, arts, it all promotes a philosophy of life. Whether or not I'm interested in philosophy, it's interested in me. I will even go further. Everyone, whether or not he or she can articulate it, whether or not they're even aware of it, every human being has a way of thinking about life and the world. They have their own worldview, if you please. I Googled some of the life is statements this morning, and I came up with just a small sampling. Listen to these philosophies that are prevalent today. There are a dime a dozen. Reebok's philosophy is, life is short, play hard. You ever heard that? Somebody says, well, you're not going to be here long, so you might as well enjoy it. Life is short, play hard. That's a philosophy. Garth Brooks' philosophy is, life is a dance. You learn as you go. Sometimes you lead and sometimes you follow. That's a philosophy. Life's a dance. Sometimes you're leading, sometimes you're following, but you learn it as you go. That's a philosophy. Charlie Chaplin's philosophy was, life is a tragedy when you see it close up, but a comedy when you look at it from the long range perspective. Someone has said, life is a roller coaster. It's full of ups and downs. Dale Carnegie said, life is a chance. So take a chance. And then that great theologian, Forrest Gump, said, life is a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. Now, all of these life is statements are philosophical statements. And somebody says, well, I'm just going to pick which one I like and I'm going to go with it. But you see, dear friends, a correct philosophy is very important, because if you follow the wrong one, then it will lead you astray. Last time in our study here in Ecclesiastes, we noticed that the preacher, Solomon, explores a number of popular philosophies of life. He explores the philosophy that life is about accumulating knowledge in chapter 1. He says, I gave my heart to experience wisdom and knowledge and to know madness and folly, for I perceive that this is vexation of the spirit, that is, it's like chasing the wind. Life is about education. You know, there are many people who believe that. I'm not against education. In fact, I read everything I can get my hands on. I try to learn everywhere I go. I try to analyze what I hear, what I see through the grid of Scripture. I need to try to apply it to the template of God's word and see if it's consistent with that. I want to gain and glean as much useful knowledge as I can. I'm very interested in learning. And I've always enjoyed, my friends, being around people who are interested in improving their knowledge base. But life is more than just the pursuit of intellectual achievement. Somebody says, well, I've really lived because look at the degrees I have on my wall. Well, a degree can be very helpful, but it is not in itself the guarantee that your life is worthwhile. Solomon said, I've already tried it, and I can tell you it's all vanity, which means it's futile, it's empty, it's ultimately meaningless, it doesn't add to the real needs of humanity. Then he came up with this other philosophy. I'm going to see if life is a matter of pleasure. Chapter 2. He said, I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. The word mirth here means laughter, joking, like a comedian. Now, there are people who just love to read the funny papers. I've heard it said one time that you can tell a lot about what a person believes by how they read their newspaper. If a person is a sports fanatic, they pick up the sports page. If a person's politically minded, they pick up the editorial page. If a person is interested in his investments, he picks up the stock market and the Dow Jones Industrial Average page. And if a person's going crazy, he picks up the funny papers. I'm afraid, dear friends, that's one of my favorite parts of the newspaper is the funny papers. But life is more than just laughing. I love to laugh. I enjoy a good joke, clean humor. I enjoy a turn of phrase that is unique and humorous. But my beloved, life is more than just mirth. It's more than just pleasure, more than entertainment. Now, if anybody had the opportunity to explore recreation, leisure, entertainment, taking a vacation, you know, spending time on the lake or on the beach or in the mountains or going to exotic places, Solomon had resources that enabled him to do that. In fact, in chapter 2, he says that he acquainted himself with wine. He's a wine taster. He acquainted his heart with wisdom. He said, I had mirth, I had laughter, I enjoyed pleasure. But he said it was all vanity. And then he explores the idea that life is a matter of accumulating possessions. You've heard the old saying that many people live by the philosophy, make all you can and then can all you make and sit on the lid of the can so it doesn't escape. That's right. A lot of people live by this idea that life is about the things that you accumulate, houses, lands. And in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, Solomon says that I got men servants, maid servants. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and orchard. I made houses. In fact, other passages describe the building projects of King Solomon, and they are impressive. 30,000 construction workers were on his payroll. 30,000 workers. Billions of dollars in modern currency, no doubt, were spent as he built pools of water. That is, he had his own jacuzzi, his own hot tub, his own swimming pools, and more than one. He had places on the coast, places in the hills. He had all sorts of elaborate places. He had investments aplenty. In fact, the Song of Solomon, that book in your Old Testament, is the story of Solomon the king's real estate holdings down in the hill country of Bethlehem, Judah. He owned a vineyard down there, and he had let it out to sharecroppers, to keepers. Chapter 8 of Song of Solomon explains that in vivid detail when it says that Solomon was to have 1,000, and they were to receive the balance of the profits that they made every year that they grew, that their harvest came in. It was a sharecropping arrangement, and every once in a while he would go down and look at his business holdings down there, see how everything was going. And it was on one of those trips that he met the Shulamite that became his beloved, the only one of her that bare her, his love, his dove, his undefiled. What a beautiful picture of Christ in the church we see in the Song of Solomon. So Solomon was a very wealthy man, and he said, I gathered all of these things. But you know, Jesus reminds us in the 12th chapter of Luke's gospel in the 15th verse, beware of covetousness, that is, the desire to just get more and more and more, because a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things that he possesseth. Wouldn't we be better off if we could remember that? Life is more than things. That very word, things, has a hollow sound to it, doesn't it? It rings empty. A man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things that he possesseth. Solomon says, though, I gathered it all, but he said it's all vanity of vanities. That word vanity, again, means futility, empty, meaningless, fleeting, not satisfying permanently. It doesn't really satisfy it. There's a temporary high, but yet in the long run, there are very few people on their deathbed who say, you know, I wish I would have bought instead of sold. I wish I would have made better investments. I wish I would have had a better car to drive. The very few people on their deathbed who regret material things, you know what people say in their dying hour? I wish I'd have spent more time with my family. I wish I would have been more devoted to the Lord. I wish I would have read the Bible more. I wish I would have been more in control of my attitude. I wish I would have been more Christ-like and more useful in His service. That's what people say when they come to the end of their life. So Solomon is sharing his philosophy, and he's telling these young people in Ecclesiastes, I've already tried it all. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could learn from the experience of those who've already gone before us instead of having to repeat the same mistakes in our lives today? Solomon says, young men, young ladies, I've tried pleasure, I've tried education, I've tried material possessions and wealth, but it is all vanity and it's like chasing the wind. You can't really catch up with it. You can't grasp a hold of it. It's elusive. Trying to find fulfillment in life in that way, dear friends, is ultimately meaningless. It all leads to frustration and disappointment and despair. Do you know why that's true? Do you know why pleasure can't ultimately satisfy? Do you know why wealth, money, material possessions can't ultimately fulfill you? Do you know why knowledge can't, in the final analysis, add fulfillment and meaning and purpose to your life? Here's the reason. He tells us in chapter 1, because both the wise man and the fool, both the rich and the poor, none of them can escape problems. None of them can escape sickness. None of them can escape changing circumstances. None of them can escape death. Listen to chapter 1, verse 15, when he says, then said I in my heart. Now he's already talked about his pursuits of possessions, his pursuit of wealth, his pursuit of pleasure, his pursuit of knowledge. He says, then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. There's something that happens to the richest person as well as the poorest person in the world. You know what that is? Suffering, problems, and finally death. Listen to this. Then said I in my heart, this also is vanity, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. Seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? He may have a longer funeral than the poor man, than the fool. He may have a funeral stretched out over several days, but yet he says they still die the same. There's no remembrance of the fool. He says, how dieth the wise man? As the fool. Just the same. Doesn't matter whether you were of a higher echelon, a higher socioeconomic status in this life. He says, the same thing happens to all. Somebody says, well, Brother Mike, if that's the case, then what's the purpose of life? Here's the point of Ecclesiastes. There's only one life that's worth living. Only a life that's lived in the fear of God. And that expression in Ecclesiastes means trusting God, obeying God, and honoring God. Only a life lived fearing God and keeping His commandments has ultimate meaning and significance. Listen to the end of chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. Now he says, as a conclusion to everything he's talked about in chapter 2, he says, here's the best counsel I could give you. There's nothing better than this. Enjoy good food. Eat and drink. And make your soul enjoy good in your labor. Enjoy your work. Work hard. Enjoy a job well done. Do the best that you can do at your job. He says, be satisfied with good meals, with success at work. This I saw that it was from the hand of God. Notice how he factors God into the equation. What Solomon is telling us here is that with God in focus, the simplest and most common kind of life is supremely satisfying and fulfilling. Listen, for God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. Somebody says, I thought this was a book about cynicism, Brother Mike. I thought Ecclesiastes was a book of pessimism and depression. Well, if you don't factor God into the equation of life, then it is a book of cynicism. Life itself will bring despair and frustration and disappointment. But my beloved, when you look at the simplest things in life in view of God's presence, God's reality, living as unto the Lord, in view of God's ultimate existence, that's a life that brings fulfillment, joy. You want to have joy in your life? Anybody in here today say, no, I want to be miserable. I want to be unhappy. Have you ever noticed how many people that you meet in this world are genuinely unhappy? And I'm not just talking about putting on a smile on Sunday. I'm talking about Monday through Saturday or during the course of each week. People who just don't have any joy in their life. And you wonder why. You say, why, Brother Mike? It's because their philosophy of life is off center, off target. It's because they're looking at life as a matter of just drudgery. They're looking at life as a matter of self-fulfillment, of self-advancement. They haven't factored God into the equation. The only life worth living, I'll say it again, my beloved, is the life that is lived with God in focus. For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom, knowledge, and joy. Joy. But to the sinner, he gives travail to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of the spirit. Solomon is teaching us here in chapter 2, verse 24, all the way into the third chapter where we read this morning, that life is God's gift and it's meant to be enjoyed. Now, with that said, let's look at chapter 3, verse 1. He teaches us here in this very familiar passage, to everything there's a season, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up that which is planted. He teaches us here that life is meant to be enjoyed, even though it is constantly changing. How are we to interpret these verses, a time to be born and a time to die? You may know that there are two popular folk songs that have been composed from this passage. The first, drawing from verse 11, "He hath made everything beautiful in his time," was written and sung by Ray Stevens, the popular country music singer, some years ago. "Everything is beautiful in its own way." You've heard that, haven't you? That's taken from Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11. And what Ray Stevens is basically saying in that song is that there's a moral value in respecting people who are different than you. Now, that's an important lesson. I think it's a legitimate lesson that we need to respect people who are different skin color, different social status, different ethnicity, different in their life experiences. We need to not be afraid of what is different. You know, I have a dog who is fear aggressive. Some of you have found that out when you come and knock on my door. And the reason is because he's afraid of anything and anybody who's different. And there are a lot of people like that. So Ray Stevens' song is very useful. He's saying that there's a moral need to respect other people who are different. Everything is beautiful in its own way. That's what he's saying. That's fine as well as it goes. Certainly not a Christian message. It is a moral message, though. The other song was written by a man named Pete Seeger. It was sung by the Byrds back in the 1960s. Very turbulent time of protests. The Vietnam War was ongoing. The hippie movement was strong. There were a lot of anti-war people out there. And in that song, the Byrds sang, "To everything there's a season and a time, to every purpose under heaven." They quote the first 11 verses, or the first 8 verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verbatim to the King James Bible, except for 6 words. At the very end, when Seeger writes and the Byrds saying, "There's a time for war and a time for peace," and he comes to this conclusion, "A time for peace," here are his editorial comments, "I swear it's not too late." Now, what he's doing is he's promoting this message of world peace, saying that we need to quit fighting. We need to have peace in the world today. So he's promoting a philosophy too. How are we, though, to interpret this passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 3? There's a time to get, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to cast away, a time to rend, and a time to sow, a time to keep silence, and a time to speak. How are we to interpret this? Well, there are basically three possibilities. First of all, some people think that this passage teaches that everything has a time and a place when it's appropriate. Somebody says, okay, there's a time to speak and a time to keep silence, so this isn't the time to speak. This is the time for you to keep silence. That's what's appropriate. It sees the passage, in other words, as instruction, like the Proverbs. The book of Proverbs is full of wisdom, instruction for life. Ecclesiastes really isn't written with that goal in view. It's not giving us wisdom or instruction on how to live as much as reflection on what life is all about. This passage really isn't instructive, it's reflective. But there are a lot of people who see this as an instruction, that there's a time to embrace, and there's a time to refrain from embracing. A lot of parents have used that with their teenagers who had a boyfriend or a girlfriend. There's a time to refrain from embracing. Church is not the time to embrace. You know, I understand there's a sense in which we could use the passage as instruction, but that's not its primary purpose. The second popular view, and by the way, this is the most popular. Some people read this passage in Ecclesiastes 3, and they say that this means that everything that ever happens is predetermined and prescripted by God so that it cannot be changed. I have a number of commentaries in my library, and I would have to say that the overwhelming majority of them take this position, that this passage is teaching that everything that happens is predestinated by God. In fact, one quote that I clipped from one of the books says this: this passage means that God has made the appointed time for everything. He says Solomon was a Calvinist long before there was a Calvin. Entire books are devoted to this subject, he said, of predestined activity in life. So we can't give it full treatment here. He says, but I will choose to affirm what the Bible affirms, that God is sovereign over everything. He is not always pleased, but he is never perplexed. No evil action skirts his plans. Somebody says, do you believe that, Brother Mike? Do you believe that this passage, when it says there's a time to be born and a time to die, is teaching that the whole universe is just mechanical, like a robot, and God is pushing the buttons, and if you raise your arm, that's because he pushed a button and made you do it, and you couldn't help it? There are people who believe that it's a deterministic universe. Do we believe that as Primitive Baptists? Somebody says, I think you do. You believe in predestination. That's not what the Bible teaches about predestination. When the Bible talks about predestination, it has to do with people, not events. People, not events. Never, not one time, does the Bible say for what he did predestinate. It always says for whom he did predestinate. What's a whom? It's a person, right? Somebody says, okay, so-and-so had a terrible accident. I guess that was in God's plan. You ever heard well-meaning people try to comfort someone in sorrow by saying, well, I guess that it was just God's plan that happened. Everything happens for a reason. I have to tell you, dear friends, that always just sends chills up my spine when somebody says that everything happens for a reason. And every once in a while, I'll smart off and say yes, and sometimes that reason is because we're not using our brains like God gave us. Did you know sometimes the reason things happen is because we're living in a world that's under the curse of sin? We could take the Flip Wilson approach, the devil is behind it all, the devil made me do it, or we could take the absoluter's approach and say God is behind it all. But the fact is, dear friends, sometimes living in a world under the curse of sin means that we're going to have problems. Sometimes your tire is going to be flat. Sometimes your alternator is going to go out in your engine. Sometimes you're going to burn the biscuits. Sometimes the kids won't behave, and God is not to be blamed for the sins and the mistakes of human beings. Now, somebody says, well, Brother Mike, don't you believe everybody has a time to die? It says that there's a time to be born and a time to die, and you can't die before your time. You ever heard that? That every event is part of God's plan, and everything's been pre-programmed, and there's nothing you can do about it. Well, I have three problems with that everybody has a time to go. Notice this passage does not use the word set. He doesn't say there's a set time to be born and a set time to die. If so, you have to apply that same interpretation to everything else that's listed here. There's a set time to weep and a set time to laugh. Somebody laughs at the wrong time, you say, well, I couldn't help it because that was, I couldn't help laughing because that was the set time. It was predestinated that I laugh and I couldn't help it. You know, I like what one preacher said one time. When these folks say that I believe everything that happens is the will of God, he says, well, then it must be God's will that I don't believe it, because I sure don't. And you don't have any right to get mad at me for not agreeing with you, because if God predestinated everything, then he predestinated me not to agree with you. Again, I emphasize that predestination has to do with people, with God's plan to conform his elect to the image of Jesus Christ. It has to do with people's final destiny. It doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you fall down a flight of stairs or stump your toe. Now, I know God is sovereign, and he's in control, and he's able to overrule any circumstance for his glory and for the good of his people, but that doesn't mean that everything that happens is controlled, that God rules his world like a puppeteer controls a puppet, like Geppetto controlled Pinocchio. That's not the way the world works, dear friends. Sentient creatures like angels and human beings are not robots or automatons mechanically controlled by the push of a button. We have a will, and God is more glorified when we serve him freely than he is if we serve him by force or coercion. God will not make you join the church. He will not make you do right. Now, he'll make you wish you'd done right. If you don't do right, he may put a whooping on you, you know, and he make you regret it, but he will not pick you up by the hair of the head and make you do right. Heard about an absolute one time who fell down a flight of stairs. He believed everything that happened, he couldn't help it, you know, and he fell down a flight of stairs and got down to the bottom, and he got up and brushed himself off, kind of straightened his tie, and he said, whew, I'm sure glad that one's over. That's the way a lot of people live. My beloved, you know, that man could have watched his step a little closer, right? Could have been a little more careful. Everything that happens is not predestined. You say, well, what about this time to die? Doesn't everybody have a set time? If that's true, may I ask you a question? Why would you ever observe safety precautions? If you went to the beach and you went swimming in the ocean, somebody says the rip current is really strong today. Well, I'm not worried. If it's my time to go, I can't help it. Right? Why would you ever stop at a traffic light? If it's not your time to go, you're not going to go. You see, the person who believes that really contradicts that philosophy when they stop at a stop sign or step on the brake or obey the laws of the land. If this is true, that everybody has a set time in which to come into the world and a set time. Now, God knew when you were going to be born. But the fact that God knows everything doesn't equate to the idea that God causes everything. He's omniscient. He knows it all before it ever happens, but that doesn't mean that he causes it. God has put himself at the behest of the prayers of his children. And he said on one occasion, you have not because you what? Ask not. That indicates to me that there are blessings that I've missed that I could have had if I would have been more prayerful. So there are certain things, my friends, that we are responsible for in life. One of them is our own obedience to him. By the way, if this is true, that there's a set time to die, how does this passage in Ecclesiastes 3 square with this verse just a few chapters later in Ecclesiastes 7:17 when he says, be not overmuch wicked. Don't just throw caution to the wind and sow your wild oats and live like the devil. For why shouldest thou die before your time. Now, what's the time to die? Usually about 70. Right? That's the average. But you know, there are some young people whose lives have been cut short because they got involved with drugs or alcohol. I know there are accidents as well that have happened, and I don't want to get too specific lest we are inappropriate, but I would say, dear friends, that a person can so live that they cut their life short in quantity of years and certainly in quality of life, right? You say, well, that was just his time to go. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. God knows when Michael Goins will breathe his last. That doesn't mean that it is predetermined. In fact, you remember when Hezekiah was about to die, God sent him the message, set your house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and he began to weep and pray. And God added 15 years to his life. He extended his life. You say, well, he had a set time to die, but that wasn't a set time. That actually 15 years later, then God told a lie, because he's the one who sent the message to the king saying, set your house in order, for you're about to die. Perish the thought. God cannot lie. He said, then, Brother Mike, if this doesn't mean that there's a time and place for everything, and if it doesn't mean that everything that happens is predetermined and predestinated by God, what does it mean? This passage in Ecclesiastes 3 is a reflection on the fact that life consists of seasons. Life is a matter of seasons. Now, nature is a matter of seasons, right? We've had summertime for the last few months. Been wonderful. I enjoy it. But you know, the leaves are starting to fall off the trees. And the temperatures are starting to, well, they're not starting to change yet, but they seem like they're getting hotter. But anyway, they will change in time. And just as sure as you're here this morning, summer will change to fall and winter. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter shall not cease. Genesis chapter 8. That's a guarantee. Life is a matter of adapting to the changes that come our way, just like we adapt to the changing seasons. There's a time to be born, a time to die. In your life, you're going to face these two seasons, birth and death. In your life, there's going to be a time to plant, and there's going to be a time to harvest what you planted. That's true, isn't it? By the way, churches have seasons. Sometimes it's winter time in a church. And the challenge then is not to just give up and throw in the towel and hang up the cleats and say, I quit. The challenge then is to batten the hatches, to buckle your seatbelt, to hang on and to survive, because spring is coming. I guarantee you, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the time of the flowers appears on the earth, revival will come. Churches go through seasons, families go through seasons. Sometimes it's spring, a time of renewal. Sometimes it's summer, a time of gathering. Sometimes it's winter, a time of trial and affliction. But my friends, every person here is going to go through seasons in your life. You're going to have changes. In fact, the hymn writer puts it poignantly, change and decay and all around I see. You won't escape and I won't escape. Did you know that? You're going to be sick some. You say, well, I've had perfect health all my life until I got to be 80 years old and suddenly I'm having to go to the doctor and my body's breaking down. That happens. That's life. Because to everything there's a time and a season. Life changes. There's a time of conflict. There's a time of camaraderie. There's a time of tension. There's a time of relative ease and peace and quiet. There's a time to get. There's a time when you prosper. There's a time when you lose. Now, that's true in the lives of individuals. That's true in the lives of families. That's true in churches. Every one of us will go through seasons. What a realistic perspective this is, wouldn't you say? This is ultimate healthy-mindedness, to think like this about life and never to become discouraged then whenever something changed. You said, I was in good health and now my health has failed. I just feel like God has forsaken me. Don't be surprised, my friend, when trials come, because that's part of living in this world. And as long as you live in this world with a view to the God who's beyond the sun, who is in back of it all, who loves you, and who's promised to be with you, then you can go through the changing tides and seasons and ups and downs and highs and lows of life, my beloved, knowing that God has promised grace sufficient to you and me in the midst of the mountains and valleys of life. The believer is somebody that knows that although times and circumstances change, the Lord is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He does not change. Aren't you glad to know that? The God who lived in the olden times is just the same today. So my friends, in light of God's presence and grace, the believer is somebody who can actually find beauty in every season of life. As verse 11 says, he hath made everything beautiful in his time. Notice the difference in this passage between a time to be born, a time to die, a time to kill. But now in his time, that's God's time, he's made everything beautiful. Are roses very beautiful in the winter time? I mean, as a rule. I know if you've got a hot house or, you know, if you have a green thumb, you probably figured out a way to preserve. But as a rule, are rose bushes real pretty in the winter time? You know what mine look like? Long stems and long hooking thorns. No beautiful petals, no fragrant flowers, but in God's time, on his timetable, there is a time when that rose will bloom again, you see. In his time, here's the point. Every season has its beauty if you're blessed to see it. You see, I wish I was young again, Brother Mike. These young people, they have it all. I wouldn't be young again for $1 million. You know why? I see some of these young folks trying to figure out relationships and the heartaches and the tears, and my heart goes out to them. I've been through that. I don't want to go through. Now, it's fine. There's an excitement to being in love, and there's an excitement to, but there's also a fear, right? I've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. I don't want to go back. Now, I would like to get a transfusion from some of these little kids running around. An energy, you know, blood, if they'd give me a little energy, I'd be glad to get a transfusion from them to feel a little better. But as far as going back through life, now I don't want to discourage you young folks, because your life as a young person is a wonderful season. It's beautiful. It's beautiful to be young. It's beautiful to be a teenager, although it's very dangerous. You could make decisions at that stage in your life that you will reap the consequences of for many years hence. Be careful. Be careful. One night of drinking with the boys, and you get in a car, you have a bad accident, I'm telling you, be careful. But yet, it's so much fun to have friends and a Friday night football. But you can't go back. You say, well, Brother Micah, midlife, there are no joys in midlife. Oh, but there are. Have your kids growing up and to see them becoming responsible and, you know, and even though it's scary, and yet to have the stability of a 40-hour-a-week job, and life can be good, whatever the season. You say, what about old age, Brother Mike? That's not fun. It's hard. I know it's hard. But there are joys. Every day is a gift from God. There are joys to mature years, too, dear friends. You know what they are? Grandchildren's one of them. That's right. They're so wonderful. Why didn't you have those to start with? You know why they're so wonderful, don't you? It's because you can send them home whenever they start to get on your nerves. I'll tell you another joy of older years, and it is to be able to look at where you've been and how the Lord's taken care of you, and to share your testimony and your experience with others. If people in this fast-paced world will stop long enough to listen to you, you've got a story to tell, don't you? The church still has a place for the old. Society doesn't have any use for the old. You notice that? Our world says, let's get rid of, you know, let's just euthanize the elderly. They're a burden on society. I'm telling you, Psalm 92:15 says, "In Zion they shall still bring forth fruit in old age. Yea, they shall be fat and flourishing." There's still a place for the elderly in the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. Never forget it. Never forget it. Everything I've said this morning boils down to this. This wise counsel: "He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Therefore, I know that there is no good in the changes of life except in this: for a man to rejoice, do good in his life, also eat and drink and enjoy." Notice, rejoice, enjoy. God has given joy. Do you see joy in this whole passage? This is not a book of cynicism. Ecclesiastes is the Old Testament counterpart to Philippians. It's a primer on how to live joyfully in a changing, fleeting life. May God help you and me today, dear friends, to learn to enjoy every day as God's gift. It is the gift of God. Even in the changing seasons of life, may we see the beauty in it. May we thank God for the opportunity to rest. May we enjoy a good meal. May we enjoy a job well done. May we enjoy a marriage. May we enjoy our friends. May we enjoy the knowledge that we can glean. And most of all, as New Testament Christians, may we enjoy the fellowship of Christ our Savior and the opportunity to serve Him in His church. For there's not a more fulfilling life than the one that you're trying to live this morning. You say, "Well, church is such a burden." It is your life. Everything else is vain. But your labor in the Lord is not in vain. Never forget it. May God add His blessings this morning to the preaching of His word.